It is indeed. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world covered ever so well by this program, Coast to Coast AM. Listen, just before introducing my guest, Philip Gardner, coming up in a moment, I want to remind all of you that I love hearing from you. So if you have an opportunity, by all means, drop me a line. I am Art Bell at AOL.com, or preferably, I think, ArtBell@Mindspring.com. That's ArtBell, all lowercase, at AOL.com, or the big one, ArtBell@Mindspring.com, MindSpring.com. In a moment, Philip Gardner, he's got a master's degree in strategic marketing and 9 diplomas ranging from personal management through holistic medicine and the craft of entomology. Before retiring to dedicate his time to researching and writing, Philip was a marketing director. He was owner of a company in the UK. Part of this role included giving lectures on the art and history of marketing and propaganda to various organizations, including certain government bodies and companies. Philip is the author of Proof, Does God Exist? Well, that's a good one. And The Shining Ones, The World's Most Powerful Secret Society Revealed. He also had a program produced in Scotland called, I believe, Icon. Philip uses history, mythology, symbolism, and his own expertise of propaganda. That's interesting in itself to prove his theories. Coming up in a moment, Philip Gardner. Philip Gardner, I would like to welcome you, my friend, to the program.
Thank you for having me, the mighty Art Bell.
It's just absolutely great having you on, you know, from one side of the world to the other. Where are you located, Philip?
I'm actually, right now, I'm in California.
Huh, okay, good.
I'm over here doing TV and also all kinds of different things.
Okay, good. Well, I'm curious about all sorts of things. For example, in the introduction, it said, your own expertise, propaganda. Propaganda is a pretty interesting word.
Yeah, well, it is. It's probably the darker side of marketing, if you like, because at the end of the day, it's just marketing, and it's just being able to use those skills of how to get a point, a product, whatever, service across to somebody by understanding them. And, you know, it's psychology at the end of the day. It's knowing about a person, what their age, their sex, their orientation, their, all kinds of different things about a person, and then using that to use the right means to get the message across to them, you know. So if you're going to go for a child or you want to try and sell a toy, for instance, you make sure that you use lots of primary colours and primary shapes, crystal clear noise sounds, and nice happy music, that kind of thing, you know. It's pretty simple and straightforward when you do start to break it down.
Okay, well, break down yourself for me. Let's hear a little bit about Philip Gardner. What is your background? How do you come to all of this?
I came to it really because of say, 3 things. Firstly, in the first proper job that I ever had, there was 2 guys there that highly influenced me. One of them was deeply into history. He was a member of the Sealed Knot in England, which is the Civil War reenactment. And the other guy was in the Lord Byron Society. So it was pretty deep into Byron, Keats, Shelley, all that stuff, who were deep thinkers. And so the 2 major influences for a really young man at that time were, you know, history and the deep thinking. All the time I'm trying to do the job, but, you know, that influenced me a lot. And as I moved on, I moved up the company, and then I started to do the marketing degree and various other things. And so involved in marketing is trying to understand psychology. And so, you know, you get into the mind in a different way too. And so I think all of that tying into knowing history and then realizing that history is probably the biggest lie on the planet, the history books that we've got, you know, it kind of opens your eyes and you want to know the truth. Because
well, I think with regard to wars, they usually say that the victor gets to write the history, right?
Beyond all doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even before that, the propaganda machine's in process, making the winner, you know, making the either side appear to be the winner beforehand anyway. So
it
starts way before the war.
Right. Well, I tried to share with my fellow Americans, even when I lived in America, that we were constantly being propagandized, even in wonderful, free, best country in the world, America, and I still believe that to be true. We're propagandized. There's absolutely, totally no question about it.
No doubt whatsoever. Do you know the biggest shock since I've come here is, I mean, I've been to New York before, but I never really watched the TV. I was too busy running around that mad city, which is really nothing like America as I now know it.
Mm-hmm.
Is when I turned the television on in the hotel room, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It just appalled me. I'd flicked through, I lost count of channels of commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. Is this the mindless people watch? You know?
Well, yes, it is.
Yeah, right. and the thing that worries me is, you know, England, we always follow what America does. And I just thought, oh, no, we've got this coming.
Oh, well, it's true. I mean, I'm in the Philippines right now, and it's very much the same way. Everybody, from an entertainment point of view, pretty much follows what America does. We're clearly the leader in the world of entertainment. Our movies are enjoyed throughout the world.
Yeah, beyond all that. Yeah.
And what America thinks, pretty much the rest of the world is exposed to. They call you the British Indiana Jones. Why?
Probably because a few things that I do, I do dig quite a lot in both physically and, you know, in textually. And I have been known to infiltrate secret societies. So
really?
Yes. So
for example.
Well, I'll give you a recent example, if you wish, for a book that I'm working on for next year in Germany. I was researching the ancient order of the Holy Vamp.
Wait a minute, the Holy Vamp?
Vem, V-E-H-M.
V-E-H-M.
Vengeance.
Okay.
And they began in the medieval period, much like the Templars and the Knights of St. John, etc. And mm-hmm. It was said that they erupted again during the Second World War, and that Hitler used them as henchmen to do all kinds of things. And what they did were supposedly do judgments out in the woods in the middle of the night, etc. And they had a judge who was like the Grand Master. And what I wanted to know was, did they still exist? And
mm-hmm.
because if they'd existed in the Second World War, who's to say that they no longer exist now?
That's right.
So I contacted a few people that I knew. One of them was in the Golden Dawn in Surrey in England. And he put some feelers out. And within 2 days, I was in Berlin, stood outside the Berlin Dome Museum. And the two old gentlemen that I was supposed to meet turned up dressed in nice black suits. I mean, this is all sounding very X-Files, but it actually happened. It was incredible.
Well, I'm listening. I believe you.
I got a tap on the shoulder. Mr. Gardner, yeah, well, come with us. And they led me to this, get this, this is not, no bullshit, but lead me to this black Mercedes car and drive me out of Berlin to discuss this Holy Vem, which these two were claiming to be quite high up in. And we ended up in this cafe, which looked perfectly ordinary on the outside. But when you got inside, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. There was pictures of Hitler and Himmler and Hess and everybody all over the walls, and a bar at the end with these, like, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guys. And they did everything according to the research that I'd done on the Vem. They turned their forks inwards on the table, which was a sign of Holy Vem. They did everything.
What actually, can you describe to me what the Holy Vem, what are they all about?
Well, today, they're really kind of a neo-Nazi organization, really, who just think that Germany should be great again and that it's pathetic that they've joined Europe in the way that they have, etc., etc. But in the past, the whole idea was that Westphalia in Germany was particularly in trouble from roving marauders and people coming back from crusades who were just robbing people left, right and centre. So these supposedly good people got together and created the Holy Van to do judgments, to take people out into the woods and who they discovered doing bad things. And nobody really ever was found innocent. And the judgment was normally very swift and meant death.
My God, Philip, isn't infiltrating a group of the kind you just described that, as you point out, doesn't do a lot of court appeal work and that sort of thing, isn't that awfully dangerous? In other words, they find you out and you're in the woods and dead.
Yeah, well, but the thing with this particular one is they knew exactly what I was after and who I was. So I was really upfront with this one.
Well, then how in heaven's name did you get as far as the Upside Down Forks?
Well, maybe I actually asked the same question. I said, you know, if this is all so secret, why are you actually sitting here telling me these things knowing full well who I am?
Yes.
And they were basically saying, well, you know, this is a bit of a propaganda for us, really. We're just saying we are here, and it's about time people knew that we were back. And you know, if anybody's going to tell them, it's you. So, oh, fair enough.
Well, I would consider that just a lucky stroke, actually. A very lucky stroke for you. Or you wouldn't be here doing the interview right now.
No,
so
absolutely.
The Holy Van and others apparently still exist. Can you kind of go through a list of those secret societies we might all know that you are sure one way or the other still exist?
Well, they're obviously the Freemasons that everybody knows full well exist, but do they know that there are other groups within the Freemasons that nobody ever writes about? Which, you know, these people actually sit there and do talk about their various products and commercial things that they've got going on, and how to manipulate markets and all those kind of things. That actually is going on, and I've been in those meetings and I've seen them. So there's that kind of thing, and then there's the Knights Templar. Most people know that there are modern versions of the Templars, especially like the one that Aleister Crowley was one of the founders of, the OTO and those kind of things. But long, long time ago, there was an old guy that contacted me, and he basically said, you know, Philip, I'm a member of an organisation, and I have to... We never ask anybody to join. What we do is we pass it on in the will, and this way the lodge or temple is always the same size. It's always a number of 13. And I'm getting old, and I'd like to pass it on to you. And I'm like, right, okay. Give me some time to think about this. And before I had a chance to think about it, the guy died. He was 86 years old, and he fell downstairs, and he just couldn't survive it, I'm afraid. So before I had any choice in the matter, I was contacted by a lawyer, and apparently I'd been left a nice painting and membership of this organisation, which called themselves the Knights of the Temple. And so I kind of went along. I was, you know, 10 years younger than I am now, only 27 years old, and I wanted to see what it was all about and went along to the initiations, which was fascinating.
Were you researching these kind of secret organizations at that time?
I was researching everything I could get my hands on, from quantum physics to secret societies.
All right, so you go to the Knights of the Temple and you're at initiation, and what does that consist of, or can you
well,
not
I'll
talk?
Well, I'll tell you. No, I don't go along to these things anymore whatsoever. So, you know, if anybody wants to join, I'll put you in my will. Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what happened in the initiation. I turned up to this place. It was actually somebody's home, and it was out in their back garden. You've got to imagine this is probably about 10 acres, so it's a big garden. And they've got this kind of... It's an underground sort of thing. A bit like, you know, the old wartime... what do you call them? They used to build them in the back gardens. I forgot what we called them now, but it's kind of a bunker in the back garden.
A
bunker. That's a good word for it, isn't it? A bunker. So we went down into this bunker, and inside this huge hall was looking very much like a Freemasonic hall. And at the far
end, were you referring to a bomb shelter?
Yeah. It looks very much like a bomb shelter in the back garden.
Okay.
And at the far end of this hall, there's a really big sort of velvet curtain with this ugly goat's head sticking out the center, just dripping. I mean, it was a real goat.
Okay.
And its flesh was just dripping, and it stunk. And the guys had stood either side of me in their white robes with their swords, blah, 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 going through all these different rituals that they have to go through, and blessing the sword and kiss and spitting on the cross and various other things.
Spitting on the cross, did you say?
Yeah, one of the things you have to do is spit on the cross.
Okay.
There you go. But the last thing was told that the goat's head at the end was called Baphomet, which is the head that the Templars used to worship. And I was told to go and kiss the backside of Baphomet. So I had to walk down to the end of the hall and go behind this curtain and kiss the backside of this disgusting-looking goat, which was just disease-ridden.
I think I would have, I'd have split on the spitting on the cross. Well, no, I'd have gone on the spitting on the cross part. I don't think I could bring myself to do that.
Well, you have to battle down the laughs as you're doing it
well,
because it's so humorous to see these rich businessmen doing these ridiculous things. So anyway, I thought, I'm going through with this, because this is, if this is the first bit, what's the rest like? This is going to be real fun.
Yeah.
And so I got to the end of the curtain, and you're showing allegiance to the Grand Master by doing this. You're showing deference to the guy, and that you can be disciplined and that you'll follow the rule. Gets behind the curtain, and there is, instead of a disgusting goat sticking out of this thing, there's actually a naked woman.
Oh.
So you're actually rewarded for actually going that far, and you kiss the backside of the woman.
Well, that certainly beats the goat that would otherwise been away. My God. All right, so you kiss this backside of a woman, and then what?
Well, then it's all kind of over. You've passed the initiation, you're in, and then you just go along, once every, 13 times a year you go along. Everything seems to run around 13s. So it's 13 times a year you go along and just meet these guys and go through the next level of teaching. There were three main levels of teaching that you'd go through. And
all right, could describe those to some degree at least. I mean, this is Templar Knights, or is it Knights of the Templar? Is there a difference here, or is it the same group?
Well, the Templars or the Knights of the Temple, they've had many names over the time, and it's evolved over time. It's changed slightly. And there is some evidence to suggest that they go back much further than history books tell us. But these were called the Knights of the Temple. How old they were is anybody's guess. There's no telling. They could have recreated themselves back in the 1920s for all I could discover.
Mm-hmm.
But the next kind of levels are just, they're very psychological processes. And you're admitted in so far, but then as they're discussing things, you're discussing basically things that Jungian psychologists wouldn't have a problem with. It's just normal stuff. There's nothing great secret there.
Then well, that was going to be my question. I mean, after going through all of this, there must have been some really good secret somewhere at some levels of the Knights of the Temple, or why even bother?
No, well, that's the beauty of it, because once you get in there, what you actually find is that all these symbols and things that they've got all relate back to simple psychology, just the methods of self-improvement, etc. And really, it's just boys' clubs. They just use it to just get on in business most of the time,
Just boys' clubs and just an old boys' network for biz, huh?
That's right. That's all I found it to be, really.
Well, that's terribly disappointing.
I know, I'm sorry.
It is. It really is disappointing. I mean, there must be something more to it. I mean, with all of the, doing a talk show of the sort that I do, Philip, you can well imagine. I've been accused of being all sorts of things, and and belonging to all of these groups, and I've sort of stopped denying it, because there's no point. If you deny it, then there's all the more reason to believe that Art Bell really does belong to these things. I don't. But that's it, huh?
It's just an
old boys network, huh?
Well, on that level, yeah. But some of these guys were multimillionaires, so Yeah, you know, work out for yourself whether it's right that people in there, multimillionaires, are discussing things with people who then turn out to be politicians later on in life.
That's a good point, Philip. Hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Philip Gardner is my guest. I'm Art Bell. My guest is Philip Gardner. Secret societies, what we're talking about right now, the Holy Venn was the first one, and then Knights of the Temple. And Knights of the Temple is, in some way, terribly disappointing. The Venn, he said, would take people out to the woods, pass judgment, and then execute immediately. That one's very serious. I wouldn't fool with that. Knights of the Temple, that's, I guess, not so serious as people imagine, or perhaps Philip didn't get to all of it. He said, basically, it's a bunch of millionaires getting together to, I guess, make more money. So I suppose that has worthy aspects to it, even if you have to kiss the whatever. But we'll be back. Hey, listen, we're going to get things like the Da Vinci Code and whether Jesus and Mary married and questions like that are coming up. So stay right where you are. Okay, we've got some disagreement here, Philip. Here's a couple of them. Larry in Rapid City says, sir, I'm a Knights Templar, and I went on up through the degrees. I'm a Christian, would never bow to the devil or a representative of Goat's Head or anything. We've been around for 1,000 years. We are for our Lord Jesus Christ at all times. And Stephen in Juneau, Alaska says, dear Art, please don't let uninformed guests like this start bashing the Freemasons with their ridiculous initiation stories. Well, it wasn't initiation of the Freemasons, it was Knights of the Temple in this case, right?
Well, it was that was what they called themselves, yes.
Uh-huh. So there are many. How do you respond to those two? How do you respond to those two?
Well, you know, the Freemasons, it was not what we were talking about for starters, so that's the second one. And the first one, there are several Knights Templar organizations around the globe, and those that that guy is obviously part of the ones that you know worship that are Christians, so that's fine. But you know, he wasn't with me, and you know, simple as that, really. What can I say?
Okay.
This is what they call themselves.
You went through what you went through.
Yeah. You know.
All right. Is there scientific evidence for the healing elements of venom and blood of the snake? Because you've got a new book called The Serpent Grail, so one would assume that the venom of the snake for this particular group is in some way healing. What does it heal? What's the deal?
Oh, right. Well, the serpent grail, there's a few things to it, and it was to try and discover the truth behind the Holy Grail, and especially the elixir of life. And
okay.
One night I was in bed with my wife one night, and 1 o'clock in the morning, reading a book, and she turned to me and she says, do you know that snake venom has been found to boost the immune system? And because I'd been so deeply entrenched in alchemy and all those kind of things for a couple of years, something sparked in my brain. And I had to run downstairs, and for just days and days afterwards, I went through everything. And 2 years later, wrote The Serpent Grail with Gary Osborne. And what we discovered was that snake venom and blood, when mixed together, actually forms an incredible immune-boosting system for the body. And that basically stops you from, you know, catching diseases and all kinds of different things, and it's been scientifically proven.
And what kind of snake? Any kind of snake?
Oh, well, no, there are different kinds of snake, because the hemotoxic snakes, obviously, which can cause coagulation of the blood or anticoagulants, which makes the blood flow more. And there's the neurotoxic snakes, which affect the nervous system. Both kinds of venom have got different elements of protein in them. And we tested the anticoagulant versions of the snake venom, which were found to be hugely beneficial when orally taken in specific mixes, And we don't.
Can you tell me? Don't try this at home, of course, folks. But what kind of snake?
I was just going to say we didn't put in the book what kind of snake or what mixes, because I'm personally, and I'm an animal lover, and I don't want any animals harming. And secondly, I don't want people to go and start messing about with snake venom, and suing me basically for, you know, getting themselves in trouble. These things were mixed with quite specific mixed quantities of blood or alcohol.
Mm.
And in fact, the whole part of the snake, all parts of the snake were used and still are used for various healing things, such as, you know, the skin is used to heal dermatological problems and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's a very ancient thing, the worship of the snake and the use of the snake physically for healing parts of the body. But there are many reasons why the snake seems to have been worshipped, not least of which being an internal mental process.
Well, I'm certainly aware, Philip, that a number of medicines given in certain dosages are harmful or perhaps even fatal, and they're poisonous.
Yeah.
But given in the correct dosage, in the correct way, have a definite healing capability. So I wouldn't be surprised that snake venom of some sort or another mixed properly and or other parts of the snake could have amazing effects. But you're saying it boosts the immune system to what kind of level? I mean, how well does it really work?
Well, that's still open for debate at the moment, but it's the scientists are really excited by it and they're spending an awful lot of money looking into it. So it's really open for debate. What all we can say is that it has been found in ancient medical materia, in alchemical texts, and in texts from India in particular, which is, you know, the real home of serpent worship. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's not at this moment. I'm not going to tell you a fair bit. It's open for debate at the moment for the scientists. They just say it is incredible. And, you know, there are several people that claim to have lived extended lives because of it.
How extended?
Well, you know, that's another thing, isn't it? Because how do you know that you're not going to, you know, that 1 minute somebody could die at 50 or die at 100? It's impossible to say whether they're extended. They claim this. The claim
well,
is boosting their life.
Right, but I mean, a claim is a claim. Has anybody actually looked into at what age these people passed away, whether it was at least, you know, past the average, or is there any way to prove that the claims have any validity at all?
Well, yeah, that's what we go through in the book, to actually go through and see how healthy these people are and that kind of thing, you know. So, to be honest, the book, it was out last year. It's a long time ago, and I can't remember every single detail about it. But,
okay.
You know,
all right. Well, how does all of this relate, if at all, to the Holy Grail?
Well, the original term for the Holy Grail, Kapa, K-P-A, meant mixing bowl. And one of the greatest etymologists that I have certainly known, Sir Walter Skeat, said that it was the term Holy Grail, Sangreal, was very early falsified. Now, he didn't say accidentally changed. He said falsified. So he's implying that somebody on purpose changed the term to mean royal blood or holy blood, which is where we get all this Dan Brown Da Vinci Code and the Holy Blood, Holy Grail stuff from. And he said, you know, what it really meant was mixing bowl. And that related entirely to the things that we were finding, not just the mixing of the venom and the blood, but also the Hindu thing known as the Kundalini, where you're probably aware of the Kundalini, where there are supposedly twin serpents that rise up your spine and converge at chakra points upon your body. And this is supposed to be some kind of energy which raises to, you know, the chief point in your head, in your skull. And what we found was that these skulls, in India in particular, were turned upside down and gilted and used for the drinking of blood and for the mixing of this venom blood. So that seems to be what became the Holy Grail, because the Scythian race in particular came into England with the Romans and via such likes as the bringing these kind of Hindu concepts with them, and bringing various other concepts which have merged into the Arthur myth. And it's quite possible that this could have given us the original Holy Grail, and it's certainly possible that it is merged with pagan myths of the cauldron, and you know those kind of things. So it's quite complex how it's actually got into the Arthurian legend, but it certainly all stacks up.
All right. Well, is there any part of this that people could learn about or read and actually use, or do you having learned about it yourself, do you for legal reasons not relate any of this specifically? I mean, everybody wants to live longer, Philip.
Yeah, sure. Well, at the moment, the best thing to do is to wait for the scientists, because they are actually quite a way down the road on this. They have been at this a few years now, so they are getting somewhere. And what they're trying to do is break down the protein structure of this venom so that they can actually get it into some sort of form that we can take, rather than actually extracting venom, because it's a very expensive and long-winded process to do that. So they're looking at how to manufacture it artificially. And I know, because I'm in touch with one of the guys who keeps telling me, you know, we're pretty close now. Maybe in a year or 2 years, we should be getting to a point where we'll be doing trials.
Okay. This is all very interesting. I would think the church would not be all that happy about this, because after all, the serpent, from a religious point of view, has always been regarded not exactly in a great way.
Well, it's certainly been propagandized that way. But, you know, even Jesus himself was equated to a serpent. It was called the good serpent by the early Gnostics, and many of the early Gnostics were known as Ophites, serpent worshippers, and these are the early Christians. And Jesus was related to be, you know, it says in the Bible, it says, he shall be lifted up as the brazen serpent in the wilderness. And this is the brazen serpent that Moses lifted up in the wilderness to heal the people of Israel. They were being bitten by snakes, and God said, raise a brazen serpent in the wilderness and tell the people to look at it. And so Jesus was equated to that. And there are many other things. You know, Yahweh, in the first century, Yahweh was depicted as a serpent on Roman coins. So the serpent is actually a worldwide phenomenon, and it's been covered up extensively. Victorian Christianity itself was responsible for covering up so much of the ancient serpent cults that it's just madness.
So, okay, there are said, Philip, to be a secret vault and secret areas below the Vatican where a lot of the kind of information you're talking about right now is stored and kept. Do you know anything about that?
Well, only what everybody else knows. I really don't have anything extra to add to that, so not really.
All right. You've written a book called Gnosis, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
The Secret of Solomon's Temple Revealed. Can you reveal some of that here?
Of course. Well, first of all, Gnosis, the word, it's a Greek word, and it's much deeper than the word knowledge. And, you know, most people say, oh, it means knowledge, but it actually originally means the direct mystical experience of the divine in the self. And that's quite a deep statement for one small word. And that's the English language, you see. English language fails miserably sometimes. So gnosis actually is quite a deep thing. And so the mystical experience in the self, that in itself is a really, really deep thing. But how does that relate to the Temple of Solomon? Well, I've spoken to loads and loads of archaeologists and historians, and the only ones that tell me that Solomon's Temple actually existed are the ones that are aligned to either a Christian or a Jewish base. Most of the independent archaeologists that I've spoken to say, well, you know, Philip, there's just no evidence to say that it was ever there. What's there is the Temple of Jerusalem. We have no idea if Solomon's Temple was ever there. At that period in time, there's just no evidence for it. And so you have to ask yourself, well, it's been written about. We have exact dimensions. We have the whole story of Solomon and Sheba and all the other things that go along with it. What does it really mean? And what it really means is exactly what the Gnostics, the early Gnostics, which came out of this stuff which were derived from the Essene and various other sects are talking about. And it's a work on the self. It's a method of balance and an ancient psychology. And it really is very, very deep. And, you know, for instance, we've got the Gnostic Gospel, the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus says to people, "For whoever does not know self does not know anything. But whoever knows self already has acquired knowledge about the depth of the universe." And that's deep, that knowledge of the depth of the universe. So they're talking about something extremely deep. And in the book, I basically go along and say, what are they talking about here is the enlightenment experience, is the experience of the inner self when you can call it altered state of consciousness, you can call it many other things, but it's a mystical experience. And it's an experience of total knowledge and total oneness. And that's what everybody has this experience.
Well, actually, Philip, even I've had it. Well, the problem with that experience, Philip, is that when you're having it, you really do feel as though you know everything. Yeah. You feel as though you are at one with the universe. But then after the experience is over, you cannot, at least I was unable to, and other people I've talked to also were unable to relate in any meaningful way that knowledge beyond saying, you know what, for a minute there, I knew it all. For a minute there, I was connected to the entire cosmos, and I sort of understood everything. But you can't take it beyond that.
That's right. That's exactly what I put in the book. That is, I've interviewed so many people now who've had this experience, and that is exactly what comes across every single time. But what the ancient texts are telling us is that they developed ways of being able to sustain that point, to get more out of it. And that's what this book is about. It's about how these people did that and how they related things to us, and why a lot of this mystical language and symbolism is the way it is, because it's kind of ineffable. What you're saying is that I can't speak what I experienced. And so they put it across in various other ways, and that's what the book's about.
Well, I'm pretty good with words. So if I actually had a conscious memory of the experience, Philip, I would absolutely be able to come up with some words to describe it other than what I did. And I, you know, when I was out of my body, I once had an out-of-body experience.
Right.
And during that very brief, or at least it seemed extremely brief period, because I was scared as hell and I just popped right back into my body.
Yeah.
But during the time that I was out, Philip, I was at one with the universe. I knew it all. I knew the answer to everything. But honestly, Philip, I can't go beyond those words in telling you anything meaningful about that experience other than that. It's disappointing.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's exactly what's been told to me 100 times. It's exactly the same thing, you know, but...
How do we know then, Philip, that it is a real, meaningful experience at all, not just some chemical thing that happened in your brain?
Well, exactly. You know, Gopi Krishna, you've obviously heard of Gopi Krishna, who says the same thing. He says, you know, at the end of the day, science can say that it's a biological electromagnetic reaction with inside of the head which causes these delusional aspects. Well, absolutely. But if the process occurs, it's got to have some sort of bioelectrical process. The question is, getting to a quantum state with this, going and talking to quantum theorists and saying, is there something else that can be going on here? Can we be doing something else? And what it could be, according to these quantum theorists, is that it could be quantum entanglement. Okay?
That would make sense, actually. Yeah. Actually, that would make sense.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty of it, because now we have a new explanation, and that's what's in the book, is the explanation that it could possibly be here, quantum entanglement. And that's incredible, because that means these theoretical other dimensions that they speak about in the quantum world, you know, especially people like James Gardner, who says that, for instance, he says that intelligence is actually programming the structure of evolution and has done from the start, and that structure is sending the message back, like DNA, into itself. So it's kind of evolving itself all the time. These are scientists. This is a peer-reviewed guy who was saying things like this. And quantum entanglement is where our particles entangle with other particles.
That's right.
And we can talk a lot more about that later on.
Yeah, okay, Philip, hold tight for a moment. That music means we're about to take a break. This is all very interesting. First time I've ever heard anybody refer to that disconnect with consciousness as quantum entanglement, but one never knows, does one? I'm Art Bell from Manila in the Philippines. This is Coast to Coast AM.